Welcome to Magic in the Moment, Mindfulness in Real Time. My name is Clayton Platt, and I'll be your host for this podcast journey. Now, for many people, practicing mindfulness has very little to do with sitting on a cushion, lighting incense, or even focusing on their breath, just paying attention to what they're doing at any moment. And doing this intentionally can create that same magic. Our time together is intended to share how mindfulness plays out in everyday life for our guests. So welcome, everybody. My name is Clayton Platt, and I'm the host of Magic in the Moment, Mindfulness in Real Time. And I'm thrilled to have today our special guest, Kathy Love. And Kathy is a two-time TEDx speaker. She is a self-care coach, a podcaster around, what is it, the Self-Care Shit podcast?
Correct.
And an author, and she is the chief community officer of the Outlier Project, which is actually where we met. And Kathy, as we get started, I was thinking back of a story you told me when we were talking a while back, and you were describing a situation where you had been living, I think, a pretty prosperous life, married with three kids on the coastline of Connecticut, and life changed. And the bottom fell out. Your husband was sent to prison. You and your girls moved to Buffalo. And you went from perhaps feeling like on the top of the world to not being on the top of the world. And having conversation with your girls about who you were and the fact that circumstances had changed, but you were still the fundamentally good people you were. And that really affected me deeply. And to me, it was a really clear indication of mindfulness in real time. So welcome, Kathy. And can you kind of build on that story for us?
Thank you so much, Clayton. I'm excited for this conversation because everyone we've had so far has been so great. So you said something that just reminded me of going from feeling like we were on top of the world to having really fallen very far from there. And actually in May of 2012, there was an article written about me in our community newspaper that talked about all of the things that I had been involved in our town and that my kids had been involved in. We had started a small nonprofit to get kids doing service work in the community and actually around the world, and showing that it didn't matter how old you are, that you could always make a difference somehow for someone. And so this article was absolutely, you know, I was so proud of it. And I remember walking down the street, or my street at the time, and thinking all of a sudden it felt like an obituary. Because we had lost everything. We lost financially, we lost everything, our house, our cars, our retirement savings. But more than that, we ended up moving our family from the shoreline of Connecticut to Buffalo, New York, which is because my family was there. That's where I'd grown up. In doing that, we lost our community, who we were so involved with and so connected to. And the kids at that time were 8, 12, and 13. So they were very involved in sports and their schools and had just such a strong base of families who were there for them and for me. And we lost that. So we did come from this little affluent town in Connecticut where you know, things felt easy and beautiful and safe. And overnight, and really within 2 weeks from the day the FBI left their card on our front door, we were out in 2 weeks. We had packed everything up and moved. And we got there to Buffalo, and I remember our first day, our house was a couple houses in from the main strip. And we walked to the corner and we looked down the street And it felt like we were in the middle of Manhattan to us. It just felt so, it was such a culture shock for us. We were now living in a duplex. The houses were close together. And it was not at all familiar to us. But that was when I remember saying to them, we haven't changed. The people who we are when we lived in Connecticut is exactly the same people who we are today. And it doesn't matter where we live or what cars we drive or anything else that we had, you know, let define us, that we were still the same people. And also when we drove down the street, to remember that the people who we might have once judged or had preconceptions about were likely not true, that those people were just as much the same as we are. And we were learning from a completely different perspective about a different, you know, a different culture, really. So it was a very powerful lesson for them, but also for me. As an adult, I had proudly worn my titles of, you know, the mom of three kids and the happy wife and business owner and PTO chair and all of those things. And I had to really work at getting to know myself and who I really was at my core without any of that.
I mean, blessings on you for being able to see that and share that. But geez, I'm really sorry that you had to go through that. And you talked to me also about in this sort of recovery from life being turned upside down and regrouping and rebuilding life, kind of going through things like codependency and also I think we talked about regret. And to me, building on that sense of how we look at things that have happened, choices we've made, accountability. So I'd love you to kind of take it from there, because I was really moved by that. And I think the person that I've gotten to know is someone who's so strong, so self-confident, and exudes a sense of, well, you got the last name Love, but love for yourself and for the world and for your community. Regaining that must have been difficult. So run me through that if you would.
Difficult is a gross understatement, right? I mean, it was, it's almost hard for me to imagine what I actually went through. And I remember saying to people that the experiences that my kids went through and that I went through with them were never choices I would have wanted to make for them. But the lessons that they learned by going through that were incredible. And I've seen it last, it's been years now, and I've seen that, how that transformed them. When we were able to, 4 years later, come back to Connecticut, they had an entirely different sense of what was important. And they appreciated the schools and the teachers that they were around. They just had such a sense of appreciation for the basics, really. And they would have much less of a tolerance for the complaints that they would hear from friends about their MacBook being delivered late, or you know, they didn't get the car that they wanted. They got the other. And so again, you know, there were things that I didn't choose to do, but I'm not grateful. I can't say I'm grateful we went through that, but I am grateful for the lessons that we learned. And that was a huge shift in perspective, was saying, what are we getting out of this? What can we do with this? that was when I first thought of becoming a coach, was back then when I thought, this has to be happening for a reason. It has to be happening for me to be able to help other people. There has to be some good that comes out of this, because it certainly could have spiraled into a lot of terrible, terrible things for the kids and for myself. And we all tried it on. I talk about that in my first TED talk, is I tried on the victim role. I wore I looked like I was struggling, and I kind of leaned into that, but it was more painful than anything, and it got me nowhere. And so it wasn't until I started to make the choice to appreciate the tiniest of things, literally the cup of coffee, appreciate the small things, be so grateful for the things that we did have, and also have the perspective of it could have been a lot worse in so many ways. So it was not easy, but it was definitely conscious choices of knowing how I wanted to live my life. If it were possible, I had to at least go in that direction, because I didn't know what was possible at all.
Before we continue, here's a word from our sponsor, Meditation for Leadership. We all feel it. The pressure to keep up, to perform, to push through. But lasting success doesn't come from speeding up. It comes from slowing down, leaning in, and creating the space to lead from within. That space is where we shift from autopilot to intention, building mindful habits that strengthen focus and calm. It's where we stay connected to our values and purpose, choosing to respond instead of react. It's where we unlock our potential to positively shape our own lives and empower others to grow and thrive. That's the work of Meditation for Leadership. If you're ready to create the space for sustainable success, visit meditationforleadership.org. What was it that Michael J. Fox says? Gratitude makes optimism sustainable.
Right.
And that clearly had some effect for you.
That is a huge shift in thinking when you can find just gratitude in the smallest things, because we were stripped of everything. But, you know, the kids learned the difference between what you need and what you want, as did I. And so being grateful and having that shift was huge, because it showed us that we had what we needed, and we always had what we needed, even if we didn't like it, even if we didn't want it, we did. And that is something that I've carried. I mean, that gratitude has not gone away, and I appreciate every bit of help that we received along the way, every person who fed into me with the teachings. You know, I didn't do it by myself. I was surrounded by people who were sending me the healthy messages that it took me years to hear and to implement, but they were there. Because like you said, I was really strong, and I prided myself on being really strong. I could figure things out. I could make more money. I could do it, but I wasn't healthy at that point. It took me years to get to the point where I understood about the codependency and my part in it, and then was able to really work on being healthy.
One of the things you mentioned that struck me really to the core was I was a strong person. And so I was forging on, but it took me a while to understand what direction I really needed to go and how to do a true reinvention. So being able to tap into the core of who you were and understand that, but also understand that, and I see this in your work, that strength often shows itself by admitting vulnerability. And your work around self-care is so important. You know, this in today's world, self-care is a word that's much more common than it used to be, but it's very misunderstood. So I would love to hear how you describe this, again, how it affected your renaissance, but also how you've put it into your coaching work.
Mm-hmm. It is, I think we could say it's overused at this point. And I always insert the word true self-care, because for me, there's a huge difference. And that true self-care is always coming back and connecting to myself, and how I do that through using breath and the things that bring me joy, and making decisions and choices for how I live my life, the people I surround myself with. All of those things to me are true self-care. And it was a very painful route to get there, because as strong as I was so disconnected from what I really and truly needed that I would use alcohol to make myself feel better for a couple hours. I would be in terrible relationships. And I remember saying to someone, as soon as I'm healthy, I'm out of here. It was like, I was aware of it, but I didn't know the way out necessarily. And so it was all these distractions. I could not sit alone and be with myself. I just couldn't. And that's where the discoveries came from, was sitting with myself and being with just myself and figuring out what I needed and what I wanted. And that's when the huge transformation happened.
So is this the type of process that you use with the people that you're coaching then to help them connect with their true selves?
Right. And the reason I use the word self-care is because what I'm really teaching is healing from codependency, which a lot of people don't understand completely what it is. They think it's relying on some other person. But to me, and in the definition that I use and coach by, is that disconnection from ourselves. And so we don't set boundaries because we don't trust ourselves. We are in denial because we don't trust ourselves to be able to handle what it is we need to handle, make the tough decisions, all of those things. And so I use self-care because everybody knows, you know, I say you're ready to get your self-care shit together, because people can relate to that need and that feeling, but they don't necessarily know where it's coming from. And that's what we look at, is real boundaries and trusting yourself, forgiving yourself, communicating clearly and not expecting people to read your mind. There's so many subtle self-care practices that we can use that change everything, our relationship with everything.
The subtle things like forgiving ourselves. Mm-hmm. That was a theme that I was sort of teaching. It was part of my blog last week, and it was the theme for my mindfulness class last Friday morning. And the elements of forgiveness that we can forgive others for what they've done to us, and we need to do that without condoning their actions, but release the power that sense of wanting revenge comes in, right? But also it most often starts with forgiving ourselves, because everyone, if you're human, you have done harm to yourself in one way or another. The person who thinks they haven't probably has done the most. And that's a really hard observation and realization. I liken it to going up into the attic. It's like, that's a scary place.
Right.
But we have to do it, right? The whatever's up there, the squirrels, the bats, the bones from someone else. We need to go up and acknowledge that. But forgiving ourselves is huge.
We're much more likely to forgive other people than we are ourselves. And not only have we hurt ourselves, but we've hurt others along the way. And that is when any pain or harm or discomfort that I felt like I caused my kids was the hardest, the deepest pain I felt. And I see when I coach people and they talk about, they can talk about the rest, but when it comes to their kids, that's when they really start to break down. But when I always use the example of how they would forgive their kids in a second, because they understand that the kids only know as much as they know. When they can apply that to themselves, saying we do the best we can sometimes feels a little trite, but we really can only do as much as we know, as much as we've learned along the way, you know, up until that point. And then when we learn, we can do better.
Amen. That we can only do what we can. We are at any given moment the best versions of ourselves that we can be at that moment. Right. And it doesn't mean we can't get better. It doesn't mean we shouldn't get better. But it also, if I'm hearing this correctly, means we shouldn't beat ourselves up for not being perfect, because first of all, no one's perfect. And secondly, that sense of self-flagellation for all our inconsistencies, our foibles, our, you know, inadequacies, beating ourselves up for that is a terrible waste of energy. Mm-hmm. And only diverts us from being on the path that, frankly, we need to be on. And the one that, again, you've described, it was painful finding that path. But once you've been able to drop all the other crap, you find, okay, this is where I need to be. And this isn't going to be easy. And I'm going to make some misturns and I'm going to have to start over. But this is where I am. This is exactly where I need to be right now. There's no better place to start than right here. And that's really hard to get our arms around, because culture tells us we should be better. We have this extreme fear and sensitivity to judgment from others. But I think what I'm hearing from you as well is that self-judgment can be our biggest hurdle.
Absolutely. Our self-judgment, the anger that we carry toward ourselves, and like the way we forgive children so easily. And I ask people to consider being able to do that for themselves once they truly connect, know who they are, know why they did the things they did. It's the same as when they set boundaries. You would protect a child, no questions asked, but we find it really difficult to protect our own time and energy and emotions the same way we would do that for a child. And you just brought up another point that I wanted to address, and now I forgot what it was.
but it
is fear. I mean, codependency comes back to a lot of fear, a lot of fear of judgment. But when we really get to know ourselves, and we know that we know why we do the things that we do, and we can understand ourselves better, it allows us to forgive ourselves. And what I was about to say was that I don't believe the healing ever ends. I believe with codependency, we are all on that spectrum somewhere, and our healing can bring us toward the healthy end of that spectrum. But life keeps changing. And new situations happen, new jobs, new people, new relationships. And so those patterns that we had learned a long time ago that are now much healthier, they get reopened and we get to practice them again in a different way and just make it that much more solid for ourselves. But I don't think we ever get to the finish line. And that is also hard in this culture, is we want to get to the end. We want to be done with it. But in this healing, we just keep finding new little nuances to how we feel and what we think. And we keep evolving. We keep doing the best that we can do. And the fun thing is that we end up enjoying the process. So I love now when I get triggered, because I'm like, oh, I know what that is. And I, you know, it's one of probably my most annoying traits when I'm working with people, is I'm like, okay, this is good, because now we know where to work, you know, where we can do the work, and what we can start to feel better about. And it becomes so much fun. I really am fascinated and enjoy it so much.
Yeah. That reframing, right? That moment, it's like, boom, it's like, okay, this could be a shit show, or this is time for us to like make a new casserole out of this. Because again, I've been down this road before, and along the way, you've learned those little things that help you change the perspective on it. So I'm also hearing again that gratitude is like, I'm so glad that I've learned these lessons, because poof, here it is, right? It's Kathy time. And and being able to then share that knowledge, that experience with someone that you're coaching, and also, I would imagine in some respects, being able to visualize, I know this is where this is going to head. If we do this right, if we do the work, I know this where, and being able to translate to your client the ability to think, to visualize, to have that future memory of like, oh, so I feel bad now, this is my mess now, but I will be this other person, or I will be this other version of myself. Yeah. So that begs me to ask this question, which is, what other ways, and maybe within this as well, do you find this concept of mindfulness playing in? And in its own definition for you, again, I start this podcast with saying it, mindfulness doesn't require sitting on a cushion. But for you, how does that show up? How do those little indicators arise for you personally? And how do you potentially bring the attention to the people you're working with or the people in your life?
Well, I am in the process of healing from codependency. I coach what I know. And so I constantly am, you know, moving up and back along that spectrum myself. And it is the mindfulness is the one piece of it that is it's the constant, it's the number one thing that I bring back. So for me, I don't have to sit on the cushion, but I definitely can use my breath. And I use my breath with the intention of it bringing me back to the present moment, because all of the fear that I might be feeling in that moment comes from either the past and things that have happened that are not happening now, but that I'm recreating in my mind from the past, or things in the future that I'm worried aren't going to go the way I want them to go. And so my biggest healing technique that I use personally and that I share is to be present and to use the breath to get me there.
And are there any examples that you would use, you could share about breathing techniques? Anything specific?
Well, my go-to, because I like to keep things simple, and I know there are, you know, 4, 7, 8, and there's all the shapes and numbers. But my go-to is really based on just getting your breath to be even on the inhale and the exhale. And so I use the count of 5, 5 in, 5 out. Your 5 might take longer than my 5. It might be shorter. It doesn't matter. It's just to get the breath even. One of the best places that this has come in handy for me is when I wake up during the night. It's usually because I've been startled from a dream or a sound or something. And so if I pay attention, my heart is racing, even if I've just woken up for that split second, but my heart is racing. And so I can use it right then and there to bring my body down and calm it down so that I can then fall back to sleep. So I love it for that. But I also, when I'm having a conversation with you, When you're talking, I'm making sure that I'm breathing. When I'm on a call for work, I am making sure that I'm not holding my breath, waiting for my turn to talk. I'm not, whatever it is, I am staying present by using my breath.
Yeah, that's, and you know, it's interesting because the using the technique of the five in, five out, or four in, whatever, you know, making the even breath in, breath out, the sense of the box breathing, which is similar to that, all that is adding the hold, right? So in five, hold five, out five, hold five. One of the things I love to tell people is that the Navy SEALs use that.
Right.
Right. First responders are taught that.
Exactly. And
so that technique is a go-to. And what it's really doing, in my observation, is it's evening out the breath. So you're making sure you're breathing and also making sure your exhale is at least as long as your inhale. So the neuroscientist in me likes to remind myself that the parasympathetic nervous system is triggered by the exhale, not the inhale. But that's why we you know, what you're doing does it. But the other thing is you're following a pattern. And there's something to focus on, which is fundamental to being in the moment. It absolutely is. And I love that in its simplicity. We can use it any time of the day or night, as you mentioned. And that thing about the night, people say, well, how's that going to help me go back to sleep? Well, you just mentioned you've calmed your heartbeat down. But also, for some, if you're focusing on the numbers of in and out, you're not focusing on ruminating. You're not focusing on the mind chatter. It's like counting sheep.
Right. You're not counting how many hours until you have to get up and all of those things. I mean, if you notice, I'm using my breath right now and you can't tell, right? So we can use that in the grocery store, in the doctor's office. We can use it. It's always there for us. And it, you know, we don't have to pull the cushion out. So I love that.
Yeah, and I happen to love the cushion, but it's not the only place that I try to be mindful. And there are times when I try to remind myself I'm walking the dog, and I might be listening. I constantly listen to podcasts when I'm walking the dog, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I learn a lot. It entertains me. But there are times when I just want to be with a dog. And that's a very different experience than listening to music or listening to a podcast. Now I'm aware of what the dog is aware of. And that's kind of cool, because now I'm like, look at those birds, feeling the temperature of the air, maybe noticing the smells that I didn't notice before. And all of those things make life richer, but there are also things that we can remind other people about that's a reminder of what's happening right now. So we can set the stage to see that, or we can use that as sort of our anchor to come back, right?
Mm-hmm. And if we're only doing what is happening right now, it can keep us from being exhausted at the end of the day, from having lived out these scenarios from the past and the future all day long, and our mind is racing and racing and racing, and then we get to the end of the day and we feel like we're exhausted. So that staying present and just doing what's happening right now, at the end of the day, we can feel like we only lived one day instead of many.
Yeah, and I think that also underscores the myth of multitasking. Because if we're truly just in this moment right now, we're not trying to answer emails, send texts, scroll or whatever, when we're also supposedly having our concentration on something else. We know, again, from a neuroscience standpoint, that we can't be concentrating on two executive functions at the same time. So then we're just bouncing back and forth, which is sapping us from energy. And a project will take much longer And I realized that when I put my mind to something and I'm just there and throw myself into the flow of that moment, it takes less time and feels a lot more rewarding.
Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of people will say they get up really early because they can get so much done before, you know, before everybody else wakes up or before the phone starts ringing, is because you have that uninterrupted time that's so rare during the day.
So the self-care you talk about is, again, I think much richer and deeper than the common use of self-care in social media today. And I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with how self-care is described. I just think it's overdone.
Right. Absolutely.
But at the same time, I think one of the first conversations we had was a Zoom conversation, and it was a very productive conversation, and you were on the treadmill. And I was sitting there going, oh, dude, there was something very cool about that.
And I'm on it right now. I'm just not walking.
But if you were walking, you have an amazing sense of balance. But but that, I looked at that and I went, why not? Because, you know, this was sort of an introductory conversation. We were covering a bunch of different stuff, getting to know each other. But you also are taking that moment to say, this is what I need. This is a time I can do it. And I go back to like boundaries. That's fine. That's, to me, that's you time. That's a way you can multitask, because you're not doing any two executive functions. You're doing one physical function and then that conversation, and you were all there. I never had to worry about, you know, but we've all had these other conversations. And I was thinking about this. I was pitching someone years ago for a training program around mindfulness, and it was a phone conversation. And during most of the conversation in the beginning, I could hear the gentleman typing. And I knew I wasn't getting through. At the end of the call, I said, when we were talking in the beginning, I'm no judgment here, were you emailing or texting? And he said, yes. I said, I could tell when your concentration came to me and it felt very rewarding. And by the way, that's what my training's about. Because that right. difference you can feel, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the point about the being on the treadmill and the thought that you might have a judgment about that is healing from codependency. And it's the last step in setting boundaries, is not being afraid of the backlash or what somebody else might think of you. Because if you had thought, you know, this is unprofessional, this is, she's not paying attention, all of those things, I know exactly what I'm doing. And I know that I'm paying attention, and I know that I'm responsible and professional and all of those things. And so that last piece of the boundary setting of letting go of the fears that we may have that people might think about us is that last step of the healing. So I love that.
Yeah. And I really appreciate you sharing that example. It's beautiful, beautiful. How does your staying present now show up for your kids?
Oh, I get to practice it all the time, Clayton. My kids are in their early 20s. And so they have a lot going on. And I could easily spend all day and all night worrying about how their stories are going. And so I have worked really hard to let go of wondering where they are, if they're safe, if they're doing all of these things. And they've had some serious situations that I won't go into, but really serious. And so I have to, my response to that has been, me, my life, my body, I'm good. So I'm going to always start there. And then when I think about them, I know that they're on their own path. They have their own lessons to learn. They're on their own time frame. schedule. So if I think they should be doing something, that is not for me to decide when it's going to happen. And that has all come from staying present. I cannot worry about the future with them, or their futures. That is their responsibility to make their mistakes, learn their lessons, and do their own thing. So staying present has been a lifesaver for me in the situations that they've gone through. And I know that they see it. I know they understand it. And I think over time, they're getting a deeper appreciation for it.
It's really great modeling. You know, are you aware of the book, The Anxious Generation?
I'm not.
Jonathan Haidt wrote a book a while back called The Anxious Generation. And it talks about two important concepts, or I guess, that really changed the way kids grew up. The one that's most obvious to us now is the fact that Gen Z, and I think your kids would qualify as Gen Z, were the first generation to grow up as adolescents with a smartphone. Mm-hmm. So having that really changed the nature of young adulthood. And there's a whole conversation about that. But also, as parents, and I was a parent starting in the late 80s, we were more anxious about our children's interactions with the community and, you know, getting hurt and all this stuff. And we became overly protective. And letting your children experience what they need to experience, to learn the lessons they need to learn, to be there when they need you, but not to be so over. And those boundaries on parenthood are so
huge.
Important, right?
Huge, because you talk to a lot of people who are just consumed with their kids' lives, and they don't have any hobbies, or they're not spending time on themselves because they're so entrenched in what their kids are doing.
Yeah, and that balance, and it may not be actually, it may be a harmony, right? Because I talk about, you know, work-life balance. It's like, it's rarely actually balanced. It's like sometimes you need to be working 18 hours a day, and sometimes you're working two hours a day, right?
Yeah.
But that harmony of where your attention needs to be, where your support needs to be, where your focus is, and having enough focused inward and supporting yourself, doing self-care. And self-care, as you've described it, living into what fulfills you, living into building the best version of yourself, and having happiness. I like the word happiness. I like the word fulfillment, the sense of I know why I'm here and I'm living into it, and I have a North Star, whatever that can be. But as parents, we do share that time with making sure that our kids have opportunities. And that's hard, but I think it really defines being in the moment, being mindful of whose need is most important now. And we have seen parents who have, as you described, so absorbed with everything kid related and going, you know, the summer's just filled with travel this, travel that. And again, I bow to the parents who do that. I don't judge it. But I think sometimes there's such a give up that at some point there's a price to be paid for that, right?
That's the reason for the empty nest syndrome, right? It's that there's no connection for the parents between themselves, you know, to themselves or to each other, because the focus has only been on the kids. Of course, it's okay to focus on the kids, right? And everything. Right. But my kids 1,000,000% know that I love them and I am here for them and I will always be here for them. But they also know that I'm not paying their bills and I'm not making their doctor's appointments and I'm not calling to make sure they're up for work on time. So it's I think it's just a, not a balance, but it's really a decision. Mm-hmm. It's really a choice, yeah. Honestly.
So it would be very neglectful of me not to talk a little bit about the Outlier Project.
I know.
And I'm going to actually repeat that again, the Outlier Project, because the first time I said it, it was a little garbled in that. There's some, I have to own that and laugh at myself. Talk a little bit about the Outlier Project, what got you involved, and sort of what does that community do, and how does it support the members?
Well, the witness to my healing is Scott McGregor, because I've been working with him for the last 9 years, and we have both, gone through a lot of life's situations, and really, he has seen the transformation. So about 5 years ago, he is the idea maker, and then I'm the make it happen person. And so he came up with this crazy idea to start a community. And 5 years later, it's what you ended up joining and getting to know. And this conversation and you and your friendship is exactly what the Outlier Project is. It's just a group of the most amazing people who are just good people who support each other and help each other grow and learn. And we're all over the world. So it's a monthly membership community. And we have a lot of focus on creating events for learning, development, and building amazing relationships. And I'm the chief community officer, which is just code for I have fun all day long talking to people and helping people and, and doing all things Outlier.
Well, it is an amazing group, and I've met some fantastic people already, and I'm looking forward to meeting more and more fantastic people, because there's no limit to the growth of that project. And I will say, I thought the universe had a strong impact on why I joined, because the mascot of the Outlier Project is the platypus,
and right,
who better to wear that emblem than a plat?
That's right, exactly. Yeah, it's the platypus, who no one knows what it is. It's kind of like the outlier mascot of we are all unique individuals doing our own thing, and no status quo happening there.
Absolutely. This has been a wonderful conversation, Kathy. I so appreciate you making the time for it. I appreciate your support of me in joining the Outlier Project, but also just all the work that you're doing to support others with their deep self-care, their true self-care, living in a very mindful way and modeling that for your kids and everybody around you. Blessings to you. And here's to people reinventing their lives and taking ownership, looking codependency right in the face and saying, what do you got for me next? What can I learn from you? How can I get stronger? So thank you for that.
Thank you for having me. And I'm so proud of both of us. I was about to say you, but I'm proud of both of us, because we really nudged each other along to get our podcast going. And here we are doing an episode together. So
that's so cool. Absolutely. Yep. Not letting the pursuit of perfection be the enemy of the good.
Exactly. Exactly. Yep.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Kathy.
Thank you.
As always, I want to thank our guests today for sharing their stories, as well as my producer, Marianne Sanders, for all her work behind the scenes, and finally for the support of my friends at Meditation for Leadership through their sponsorship. Until next time, this is Clayton Platt reminding you to look for those moments of magic in your life that lead to mindfulness in real time.